Greetings and welcome to the number one place on the internet for all things collecting, what's very rapidly becoming a destination for people who want to know about all different types of collecting. It's the Collector's Show with Harold Nickel. This week in the interview segment, we're going to be talking with Amanda Everard. Amanda is the owner president of Everard Auctions and Appraisals. She is a former Sotheby's English furniture expert. She also happens to know a great deal about cameras and collecting cameras, what to look for, how to know if the camera you have is worth hanging on to. It's a little far afield for Amanda, far different than what she typically does in her role at her own auction and appraisal house or at Sotheby's. And like the last few weeks, Amanda is also a regular on the popular PBS television program, Antiques Roadshow. So we've got ourselves quite a string of Antiques Roadshow veterans joining us here on the Collector's Show. I'm really happy that Amanda is going to be on with us and will be educating us about collecting cameras. In the meantime, just like always, we're going to talk about some news from the world of collecting. Here's a story for us that comes to us from Florida, in fact, Jacksonville, Florida. Mark Sears of Jacksonville went on a quest, and it didn't take long to find his quarry, which was a mint condition Hot Wheels Flintmobile featured in the iconic cartoon The Flintstones. Now, you'll remember that a couple of months ago, we talked about Hot Wheels, and we talked with the gentleman who owns the world's largest collection of Hot Wheels cars, and they are very collectible. Mark Sears, the lucky man who found this toy car, was among many who visited the Retro-Rama Vintage Pop Culture Collectibles show in Jacksonville. He, along with 1,000 of his neighbors, went there to look for collectibles, and a lot of the proceeds, of course, went to charity, but he was looking for this hard-to-find Hot Wheels car, as well as what is widely considered the world's first action figure, the original G.I. Joe, which was introduced by Hasbro in 1964. I happen to own two, by the way. That's what I mainly played with when I was a kid and still do now, said Sears, 43. Okay, I own one, but I don't play with it. At least not that I'd be willing to admit to in a newspaper. Ed Tucker, also of Jacksonville, a retro toy and movie memorabilia collector, organized the Pop Culture Collectibles show, the event attracting more than 40 dealers featuring vintage toys. I'm really getting more and more interested in the topic of vintage toys, particularly G.I. Joe, as, like I say, I own but do not regularly play with the one that I had, and I think I got it when I was six or seven. One of the things you may or may not know is that our cousins in the UK are a lot more devoted to antiques and collectibles than we are here in the US. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe it's because the country is older, but this story from Darlington in the UK, a comic book stash found in a man's bedroom by his widow is expected to raise thousands in an auction. Some of the world's most rare, most collectible comics will, as the Brits say, go under the hammer Tuesday, February the 11th, which is coming up pretty soon. Now, what they discovered in this late gentleman's collection were highly sought after first issues of Spider-Man and X-Men that could each be worth what the UK paper says, £1,000 each, which in terms of US dollars, I don't really know what the exchange rate is, $1,350, $1,500 each. A fair sum for a comic book. The oldest in his collection features the Incredible Hulk and dates back to 1962. Comic book collectors these days are often people with the money to collect and who buy at the top end and store the comics away. It's a little bit different than the way my contemporaries and people like me, we did it the other way around. We started cheap and then waited for the value to go up. Of course, if you have the money to go and buy an original X-Men or Spider-Man, do that. And as I've suggested before, think about sponsoring the collector show. So if you're a comic collector, you'll want to be plugged in to this auction. Anderson and Garfield are helping run this collection. And like I say, it's in the UK. So a very nice find for somebody who has money to spend on comics. Now then, a little bit more approachable collection. Have you got an old computer that you've been meaning to throw away, and it's been sitting around your house and collecting dust, and you set the computer that works on it? Well, old computers, it seems, are fast becoming hot collectibles, and a lot of the peripherals associated with them are as well. Consider Steve Emery. Now, 15 years ago, Steve was browsing stalls at what they call a hamfest, and it's a convention for amateur radio enthusiasts. So he spent $15 on what was marketed, sold to him as a small paperweight. It was 2 inches by 3 inches. That's a pretty small paperweight. So his $15 investment today, worth about $4,000. And what makes it so valuable is that it was produced in the early 1960s by a company called Fairchild Semiconductor International, a Silicon Valley pioneer. And this particular paperweight contains examples of the type of early computer chips that were used in the guidance computer for the Apollo moon missions. At the time, it was a cheap promotional item used to draw attention to this new, or at least then, new technology. And today, it's a valuable relic of an earlier age. And if you wanted to know, there's a vibrant market now for anything from full computer systems to vintage console games and even old computer magazines. The prices are rising by the year. At the top end of the market, valuations approach those of fine art, which is a lot. For example, an original 1976 Apple computer sold at an auction last May in Cologne, Germany for $671,400. That's a lot. The computer's original price was $666.66. Still, though, but before we start, you know, confusing our inability to deal with our junk with investment foresight, what you got to know, like you got to know with everything collectible, is that not every old computer is valuable. Collecting vintage computer equipment is a complex business, and the value of an item can depend on anything from its contribution to computer history, like the Apple that we just talked about, and even its position in the production run. So if you want to collect old computers, approach it the way you would any other collection. Do your homework. Know what's valuable and why. Old doesn't always equal valuable. You can also collect the old original computer games. Pong comes to mind, the original Atari as well. But don't just run out and start buying old computers willy-nilly. Do your homework. Know what's what. Okay, that's it this week for news from the world of collecting. So whether you're into comics or computers, you've learned a lot. I did. It's fun putting this together. All right, coming up, Amanda Everard of Everard Auctions and Appraisals to teach us about collecting cameras. Here on Web Talk Radio, it's The Collector Show with me, Harold Nickel. Well, welcome to the interview segment of The Collector Show. You know, in the age of the smartphone, digital cameras, and Photoshop, what's happened to cameras that needs film and who uses them anymore? Who buys them? And who really knows much about them? Well, our guest this week is Amanda Everard. You may recognize Amanda as a regular on the popular PBS television program Antiques Roadshow. She is also the owner of Everard Auctions and Appraisals, a former Sotheby's expert, and we're very pleased to have her join us. Amanda, welcome to the Collector's Show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to talk about your background and your shop and your career as a television personality. But first, I wanted to talk about cameras, collecting cameras, and why at least I, as an old journalist, really prefer the photos that were taken on film, because they just seem like they have, the photos, that is, a warmer, greater depth, just a better feeling to them than digital images. Is that something you find when you talk to collectors? They say the same sort of thing?
Yeah, I think most collectors would definitely agree with you. You know, the old black and whites were developed in silver bromide, and it just gives you a different quality than the digital images of today. There's sort of a human manipulation of the image, too, in developing them, and I think that sort of comes through to collectors. So, yes, I do think that that is why people, you know, are so interested in the older photographs.
Now, silver bromide, correct me if I'm wrong, and if you don't know, it's okay to say I don't know, but the old black and white photos that really looked like sepia that were done back in the 19th century, was that a similar process?
I don't know all the technical processes of the early photographs because I'm not a photograph expert, so I can't be specific and answer that.
Okay, fair enough. And I also wondered if there are what we might call serious photographers or portrait photographers or folks who do this for a living. Do they use film over digital?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a small, probably, portion of our buyers in our camera auctions, but there are definitely a group of users who are collectors. I'll give you an example. A friend, collector of mine, John Boddy, who is a photographer, who works a lot for Rolling Stone magazine, and he only shoots film, and he only shoots with a classic Leica camera, and that's his thing, and that's what he's known for, and his images, you know, sort of tell a story. And there are a lot of photographers out there who are still using film, and actually there's a group of young people, I think, who are coming up now, you know, who've grown up with digital and now are just, you know, since they're sort of in the field, are looking back to the past and are becoming interested in the old processes and doing different things with it.
Yeah, it's funny because as well as adopting film, younger folks seem to be gravitating back to vinyl in
records. Yeah, same type of thing, yes.
And I don't know why in my head those two seem to go together, but they do.
Mm-hmm, sort of classic.
Yeah, and the same thing that people say with vinyl records that they say about traditional film is that there's just, I don't know really what the right way to express it is, but it just has a better feel to it, the traditional media over the digital. I have often wondered if that was just my imagination, but talking to you, it sounds like there's a lot of other people who feel similarly.
Yeah, I would agree. I would definitely agree.
So let's talk about the brands or the types of cameras that people are looking to collect. Is there a particular brand that's more collectible than another?
I would say yes. It sort of depends because collectors fall into different socioeconomic backgrounds. And the great thing about collectible cameras is pretty much anybody can do it. You know, if if you're interested in Kodak, you may be at a yard sale and pick one up for a dollar. So even little kids can start collections of these type of things. But then, of course, you know, the high end, you're talking about the German Leica camera, the Nikon cameras. Those are probably your top end with very serious collectors. So it sort of runs the gamut. Some people are collectors of one particular brand, and they want to have everything from that brand. Other collectors they're interested in a certain time period, and so they will collect different brands during that time period. They come in all different shapes and sizes.
Yeah, that's a good point, what you say about socioeconomic, because we know that there are folks who have plenty of money to throw at their mm-hmm. collecting hobby, and the rest of us who have to be a little more discerning. And I was happy to hear you say that a Kodak, which is something that you could still pick up at any department store, that those might potentially be collectible.
It's true. It's true. And Polaroids, going back to your whole, vinyl and that sort of scenario, Polaroid cameras have become really hot with the younger generation, too.
I used to own a Polaroid camera that was called a Swinger, and it took mm-hmm. black and white, mm-hmm. and those were a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's just sort of the image that comes through it's sort of a throwback to what we used as we were growing up.
Now, one of the things that we know, too, about collectibles are the box that something came in. If you own a Hot Wheels car and you have it in the original box and it's in great shape and there's no wrinkles or wear marks, you're going to get a lot more for that if you tried to sell it than you are for one that doesn't have a box or for one that's beat all to pieces. Is that the same type of thing with cameras if they come with a box?
Yes, it definitely is the same in that the box will increase the price. One thing that you have to be careful of particularly with the high-end Leica cameras, if a box comes with it, you want to check that it's the original box that it came with from the factory, and it will have that camera's serial number on it.
So the serial number on the camera and the serial number on the box, those should match up.
They should.
Has anybody, and maybe this is crazy, but that's okay, has anyone ever counterfeited a box that you're aware of?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure that's happened, yes. But, no, I think, the box helps it. The condition definitely plays a huge, huge role in the collector camera marketplace. Any little scratch, ding, makes a huge difference in price, and I think camera collectors in particular are very picky about that. So any little scuff mark, et cetera, we're very careful about our conditioning of the camera when we're corresponding with clients and letting them know exactly what they're getting, because they will pay, double, triple for a perfect one versus something that's had some scratches.
Wow. That's a lot.
No, it's huge. It's really huge. And, of course, the rarity of the camera, too, plays into that.
Double and triple. Now, how, and I ask this because I just flat out don't know, but when you acquire one of these upper end, say one of these Leica cameras,
mm-hmm.
and it has a ding or a scratch, as a auctioneer or as a reseller, are you allowed to refurbish or, buff that out or paint over it, or do you have to leave those in?
No, you don't have to. There are some good restorers out there. If it has been touched up and I can see that, I do put that in my condition. Mm-hmm. Some things get replated, and I will say replated. It does still affect the value.
Okay. So if I were to bid on something at auction and it had been replated or painted or mm-hmm. its appearance had been changed in some way, you would have to make note of that.
Yeah, I mean, I would, just because that's the way I am. There are quite a few unscrupulous those people sure. out there who are not going to point that out to you.
Yeah, and, you know, I mentioned the counterfeit boxes, and counterfeiting and fakes comes up all the time. So it's not a surprise that even in something like cameras that would be an issue.
So that's definitely an issue because, you know, some cameras, the really rare prototype-type cameras, can bring, you know, several $100,000. So, obviously, you know, nobody's going to fake, a camera that's worth $10, $50. But on the higher end, there are a lot of fakes out there. There was a period when Russia was making a lot of copies of Leica cameras. And they sold them under their brand, and those same cameras with some unscrupulous people have been changed into, like, a top plate might be removed and put the Leica brand name on there. So they look exactly like a vintage Leica camera, but they're actually a Russian knockoff. So those definitely appear in the marketplace. And, you know, if it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
Of course.
And we recently had a camera sent down to us from a client up in Pennsylvania who had come across what he thought was a Leica Luxus camera, which is a gold-plated camera that would have been made in the 1920s.
Yeah.
As sort of a luxury camera. Well, this one also had German Air Force and Army markings on it as well, which each in their own right on a Leica camera ups the value of that particular camera. But even just using common sense, would the Army or the Air Force have a gold-plated camera?
Probably not.
Out there to use? Probably not. But whoever this was who did this thought, oh, I'll put all the bells and whistles on this, and it will bring lots of money. And so, you know, we inspected it for them and sent it back and, you know, just said, unfortunately, it is not the real thing, and it's a fake. So they're out there. My best advice is if you are collecting on the upper end to find the expert in that field. A lot you can tell from serial numbers and going back to the old factory records, which oftentimes these experts have access to and can be able to tell you if it makes sense, this serial number, the date that the serial number would have been made versus what kind of camera you have.
It sounds like in the instance of the gold-plated fake that you just had a counterfeiter that was just a little too clever by half.
Oh, yes.
You know, I mean, oh, it's gold-plated, and we'll put military markings on it. And
right.
How about a racing stripe?
Exactly.
just to add a little more panache to
Right.
Well, let's back...
It was amusing.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. So let's back up a little bit, and let's talk about how you got involved with cameras, because it's really not the thing that you were known for, not really what your expertise was in. You were the vice president of the English furniture department at Sotheby's, so how did you get into cameras?
Well, I never would have believed it myself, but it's one of those things that just happens in life, and it was kind of exciting. We did an estate in the south part of Georgia that it was an Asian collection. And you know, in our business, that's mainly what we do is estates and big collections. And we'd been there for a couple days and gotten everything ready to go. And at the very end, the client asked, you know, my husband had some cameras and he had passed away. Would you be able to sell them for me? And I thought, oh, you know, she's got a couple brownies in the back room. I sell online. I can pretty much sell anything. And, you know, sure, I can sell some cameras for you. So she brought me to this room that had 135 boxes.
Wow.
Full. No list, nothing. And I said, well, if you're fine with me signing off on 135 boxes of camera equipment, you know, I'm happy to take them for you. So anyway, that's what happened. And we brought them back to Savannah where we're based. And over time went through them and it ended up being about 1,600 pieces. And as my husband and myself went through them, we started seeing that it was a primarily Leica collection, probably about 80%. But then there was also Zeiss and Nikon and Rolly and various other brands. And So we really thought, gosh, we got to do our homework on this. And we consulted with a man named James Lager, who's sort of the worldwide expert on Leica, and he's up in New Jersey. And he was very kind and helped us. And it was kind of funny because we sent him this list that had taken quite a bit of time for my husband to put together in a spreadsheet, sent him, and he called and he said, you know, I thought when you said, you know, you were dealing with a collection, you might have had 10 or 15 Leicas, but, you know, here comes this huge list to him. And he said, oh, my gosh, it looks like the factory at Wetzlar blew up and landed in Savannah, Georgia. He just could not believe it.
That is so cool.
So that was it. And, you know, so we sold this collection off over a period of about 4 years. And as we did that and built up our marketplace, then people started coming to us with their cameras to sell. So it just sort of went from there.
So how big is the camera collecting community? Is it, you know, hundreds, thousands, dozens?
I would say it's thousands. And I it's a very international community.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, it's had peaks and valleys. It's strong right now, really, because of the sort of Germany and Asia has sort of buoyed the market.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very, very international. We've sold to 28 different countries.
Wow.
For cameras. Yeah, yeah. It's wild. And it's been so fun because the people who collect are all, you know, very nice, just so interested, and... it's like having friends all over the world because they keep coming back and buying things, and we chat on the phone and what have you. So it's neat.
I need me some friends like that come back, are nice, and buy stuff. That's the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, it's interesting. The camera collectors tend to be very technically minded for the most part, and professionals, doctors, lawyers, a lot of engineers, which makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
And really like putting together the camera systems and having all the little gadgets that go with each piece. So, and a lot of them actually have like a checklist that they go down to make sure they've gotten every single one. So
that's one of the things that I wondered about, if there was a relationship between, you know, the mechanical versus the digital, the mechanics of the traditional camera and the people who collect them. And it sounds like there are people who just prefer springs and gears to computers.
I would definitely agree with that, yes.
So let's shift gears just for a little bit and talk about you and your business and the fact that you are a member of the Antiques Roadshow cast, I guess, is the only thing I can think of. It looks like fun to be a part of that program. Tell us about that.
It is fun because it's a huge group of my colleagues that get together in a city that they, you know, may or may not have been to together before. And so you have sort of the wonder of being in a new place with people that you enjoy, and then you... sort of have a meeting, and then the next day are there early. I think we get there around 6 o'clock. And
in the morning?
Yes, in the morning. And they serve a little breakfast, which is very nice.
Well, I guess.
People prepare themselves. And then at 7, it starts, and it's nonstop till probably almost about 9 o'clock at night. And when I say nonstop, it's, you know, you get 20 minutes for lunch, and it's constant, and it's great. It's exciting. It's sort of a rush because you never know, you know, what people are going to bring up to your table, and it's fun. So you meet people from the place and have a little chat with them, and so many objects are so personal to each person, so you get a little story behind each one, and you know, sometimes they have something absolutely fantastic that you've never seen before, and sometimes they have something that's sort of ho-hum, but you know, you let them down gently and explain that it might have more, you know, sort of personal family value to them than actual monetary value. So
yeah,
you just never know.
The way I want to be let down is gently. I know I can speak for myself. But the other thing is that when I watch the program, it seems like there are just some really extraordinary things that you guys find. And the question that I talk to my television, and my wife will always say, you know, they can't hear you. But I'll say, why isn't that in a museum? And
right.
Do you ever, like, after the camera goes off, go to somebody and say, hey, you know, that ought to be in the Smithsonian or some other important art gallery? Ever have a conversation like that?
Well, I think that appraisers do. I mean, because certainly people want to know, what should I do with this object? And, you know, some people are in financial situations where they can't just donate it.
Right.
But certainly if they're in a position to be able to do that, you know, that would be, if they ask. I mean, you have to sort of be careful on the roadshow too, as far as what direction you send people, because they, you know, there's a fine line in directing people. But, you know, if they ask, then we do give recommendations of where an object might best be placed.
That's nice to know. And I've spoken with some other of your fellow cast members, and they mm-hmm. emphasize the efficacy and transparency of the folks
right.
who are on the roadshow. And
exactly.
And of course that's commendable, and you can tell folks, hey, you own something that's valuable, important, valuable from a monetary point of view, or like you say, just something that's meaningful to them in some other way.
Right, definitely.
So tell us about your transition from Sotheby's to Georgia and your business there.
Well, for us, we sort of jumped ship out of the rat race and wanted just to be, you know, closer to family. My parents are down here, mm-hmm. and raise our kids, and also be able to do what we love, and have the auction business. And what we found the best way to do that is through an online platform. So we are in Savannah, but we're sort of open to the rest of the world through the platform iGavel Auctions, which is what we sell on.
Right.
So it sort of allowed us to step away a little bit, but also be able to reach all the people that we need to. And it's pretty nice in Savannah, Georgia.
We made a similar move. We moved from the Northeast back to Southeast Texas, like you, to avoid the rat race and be closer to family members, and have had a similar experience. For your online auction mm-hmm. business, how can we find you?
We have a website, which is everard.com, and I will spell that because most people put an H in it. It's E, V as in Victor, E-R-A-R-D.com. And that's our website, and then iGavel, which we sell on, you know, we usually have about 4 or 5 auctions a year, which you can find on our website when the next upcoming one is. And certainly, you know, if your listeners wanted to email photographs of things that they might have questions about, you can always reach me at info@everard.com, and I'd be happy to look at things for people.
That's certainly a good offer, and I would not be surprised that you hear from some of our listeners. And lastly, what's coming up for you on the roadshow this year? Anything we should be on the lookout for?
Well, you know, it films in the summer, and we've gotten our list of cities, but we have not been told exactly. You know, each appraiser gets a handful of cities, so I haven't been told yet exactly where I'm going to be. And I actually don't know if the cities have been announced yet. So I can't. I don't think I'm at liberty to say, but I am. I will be down in Thomasville, Georgia, if anybody's near there.
Okay.
Which they have the Thomasville Antique Show, which is the weekend of February 22nd, and I'll be doing appraisal days with a colleague of mine, Lark Mason, on Saturday and Sunday of that weekend. So that's sort of the next upcoming event.
Yeah, Lark was on it with us a few weeks ago.
Oh,
and,
good.
So I had a chance to visit with him as well.
Oh, great.
Well, Amanda Everard of Everard Auctions and Appraisals and the Antiques Roadshow, camera expert, English furniture expert, and online auctioneer, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule to visit with us on the Collector Show this week.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Stay tuned. One final word after this on The Collector Show. I'm Harold Nickel. Well, that makes 2 weeks running with bump out music that is appropriate for the guest. Of course, that tune was Camera On by Spoon. Not one of your more famous bands, but it seemed appropriate given what we talked about today. Now, next week, we're going to learn about quirky Americana from an interesting, if not quirky, American. We're going to be talking to another Antiques Roadshow veteran. We're going to be talking with Brian Witherell. He is going to be coming to us from the West Coast, and he has the best story about selling an in-situ car collection that I've ever heard. You won't believe it, and you'll definitely want to hear it on Web Talk Radio, The Collector Show, with me, Harold Nickel. Thanks for tuning in. Tell your friends. Come back often. Visit the website, collectorshow.net, and I'll see you next week.